This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. This is Gary Clinton. Welcome to Night Transmissions. If you're listening to a show called Murder at Midnight, and the title of the show is Till Death Do Us Part, and the main characters are on their honeymoon of all things, well, you can figure out that somebody's going to be in very deep trouble very soon. Murder at Midnight is from September the 11th of 1946.
So lovely, everything about you, your eyes, your lips, your lovely white throat. I can feel it pulsing under my hands, throbbing.
Don't, Frank, you're hurting me. You're choking me. No!
Midnight, the witching hour when the night is darkest, our fears the strongest, and our strength at its lowest ebb. Midnight, when the graves gape open and death strikes. How? You'll learn the answer in just a minute in Till Death Do Us Part. And now, Murder at Midnight. Tales of mystery and terror by radio's masters of the macabre. Our story by Joseph Ruskell is Till Death Do Us Part.
Eye upon that little tint of blue which prisoners call the sky.
Ruth, I want to tell you something. Put down that book and listen. I love you.
Some love too little, some too long. Some sell and others buy. Some do the deed with many tears and some without a sigh.
You hear me, Ruth? I love you.
Some do it with a bitter look. Some with a flattering word.
Professor Clark.
Yes, Professor Clark.
Love me, darling.
Wildly?
Put the book away. Almost there now. Bridal suite waiting.
Oh, Frank. Promise you'll always love me.
Till death do us part. Another glass, darling. Come on.
It's sweet to dance to violins when love and life are fair. To dance to flute. To dance to lute is delicate and rare.
But it is not so sweet with nimble feet to...
To dance upon the air. Frank.
Darling.
You've hardly kissed me. Why are you looking at me like that?
You're so lovely.
Come over here to the couch. A shy bridegroom in this day and age? Darling, why are you acting so strangely? Well, if the mountain won't come to Mohammed... Come here, my lord and master. Kiss me.
Oh, Ruth, I love you so.
Darling, why do you keep staring at me like that? Frank.
Ruth, no.
Darling, what's the matter?
I don't know.
Please, Frank, after all...
No, don't come near me. Don't touch me. Ruth, something terrible is happening to me. It's a feeling... It's too dreadful to believe.
What is it?
When I take you in my arms, when I kiss you, I love you and I want you so that I feel a hideous urge to...
To what, darling?
To strangle you to death.
Darling?
Hmm?
Hurry, dear. The waiter just brought in breakfast. What are you doing?
Shaving. Finishing up now. Morning, Professor.
Morning, Professor. Life is wonderful.
Wonderful.
How?
Thank you.
Leave us enter the parlor, husband.
Yes. Leave a seat, my bride. Ah! What feast is this that tempts my palate? Fall to, spouse. Citrus, my favorite ice squirt. I'm so happy I feel like dancing.
It's sweet to dance to violin.
Yeah, that's right. How's it go? It's sweet to dance to violin.
When love and life are fair. Eat, dear. What's wrong?
I guess I'm not very hungry.
Frank, you're thinking of that incident last night again. You are, aren't you?
How could I have said that to you? I can't understand it. What got into me?
Now, darling, you're to forget it. Don't talk about it anymore. Don't even think of it. It was just your little joke.
Some joke. Wonder I didn't frighten you to death.
Well.
The funny thing is, the next minute I was laughing at myself, and so were you. But when I said it, I... Ruth, I can't explain it. I can't eat now.
Frank.
It was like an obsession. Yes, that's it. It was an obsession. Ruth, you're a psychologist. What does it mean? To have felt that horrible urge to do that to you. To you, I must have been mad.
Now, darling, don't say that. Don't spoil our honeymoon with this nonsense. You'll be talking things into yourself. I don't know what it is. Your nerves are on edge from your accident, that terrible crash just 3 months ago.
Please, Ruth, please, I don't want to think about it. I can still see it, that horrible, twisted wreck.
Well, you're lucky you're alive. Be thankful, I am.
She was hitting 80, showing off. I couldn't stop her, that daffy little sister of yours.
Darling.
I'm sorry, dear. I'm sorry. I dare say I felt as awful about it as you did. Brilliant student, could have been one of my best if she'd ever opened a book. The poor kid, what a way to die. Maybe if I hadn't accepted a lift to town, who knows, she might still
now,
be...
Now, please, please, darling, let's forget it. It's not good for you. You haven't been at all yourself ever since then.
No, I haven't, have I?
Well, everything has its compensation, dear. After all, that's what brought us together. Closely, I mean.
Yes, that's right. In the hospital, what... You were an angel.
Oh.
Well, you were just an angel from heaven, the way you helped to nurse me through all that time, when I was only half conscious. Nursed me and read to me. Yes, the way you read to me.
Why do you say it like that, Frank?
Well, I don't know. There's something you read to me over and over when I was barely conscious. I've heard it ever since, deep down. I can't seem to recall it, but I feel that it had something to do with my crazy behavior last night. A line. It's still with me. It never seems to leave me. It seems to make me want to do something horrible.
Now, Frank, stop talking. You're ill again. You're pale as a ghost.
What is that line? I've got to know.
Please, darling, please stop shouting. I'm with you. Your love is with you. Now kiss me, dear. Hold me tight.
Oh, so lovely. Everything about you. Your eyes, your lips, your lovely white throat. I feel it pulsing. I can feel your throat pulsing, darling, in my hands, pulsing.
No, Frank, you're hurting me. Oh, you're choking me. No!
Yes, sir?
I'm checking out. Room number? 438. Call me a cab.
From the bridal suite? Well, just a moment. There's something wrong, sir. You and your wife just checked in last night. Any complaint?
No complaint. Just call me a cab.
Oh, an emergency.
What business is it of yours? Where's another hotel?
Why, you'll find it very difficult in New York without a reservation. And if you and your wife...
I'm checking out. Who said anything about my wife? She's better off without me, do you hear? Well, what are you gawking at? She's very lovely, remember?
Would you make a nice corpse in a bridal suite? Oh, go to the devil.
Where to now, mister? Where now?
Just shake off that other cab.
I did. 3 hours ago. I told you 10 times. What now?
Just drive around the park.
We've been around and around and around. How long can this go on?
That line. What was that line? What was it?
Huh?
What was that line?
Look, pal, we going over that again, too? What line? You want the 7th Avenue line? If I'm not talking out of turn, but you must have lifted quite a few today.
Get me to a hotel.
We tried a dozen. Remember, they're full up. Hey, just who are you, mister? What's your racket?
What's that to you?
Okay, I just asked.
I was a teacher, cabbie, in a woman's college. But that's only a blind. My name is Jack the Ripper, see? But some people just call me Bluebeard.
Bluebeard? Huh? This is the end of my line, chum. Pay up and get out.
No, I won't. You can't make me get out. You can't.
I can't, huh?
No, because if I do get out, I may go back. And if I go back, don't you understand? I'll kill her.
For richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death do us part. A bridegroom, dazed and obsessed, standing on a city street, fearing to return to his bride, because he knows if he does, it will mean
murder at midnight. Now, back to Murder at Midnight and Till Death Do Us Part.
Yes? What do you want?
Good evening, sir. My name is Bluebeard. You're the proprietor of this charming boarding house.
You're drunk.
Forsooth, 'tis true. May I tarry the night?
No vacancies. Go on now, get on your way.
Where's his room? Top floor, rear, Mrs. Clark. He came in about an hour ago, drunk as you please, and he asked for a single. I'm not one to rent to drunks, mind you, but I can see he's really educated. And a gentleman, though a queer one, if you ask me, with his eyes all bloodshot. Well, here it is.
Did he say when he'll be back?
He said he was going for his bags.
I'll just wait in his room, if you don't mind. It's all right. I'm his wife, I tell you.
Well, I don't know. Something mighty fishy about all this. Well, excuse me, there's the hall phone. If it's not one thing, it's another. All right. Hello? Yes? Who? Oh, just a minute. It's him, ma'am. He wants to talk to the lady who just came in.
Let me speak to him. Hello, Frank.
I saw you go in. What are you doing in my house?
Darling, it's so good to hear your voice again. I was so worried.
Answer me. What are you doing there? How did you know where to find me?
I've been following you everywhere. I don't want you to leave me, darling. I love you.
Get out of there. Stop haunting me. I'm no good for you. Haven't you had enough? Go away.
I won't. You need me. I'm your wife. Come back to me, Frank.
Come back. How can you still want me? What are you inviting? Why don't you take a train home? Do you want to die? You know I'll kill you the next time we're alone. You know I've gone mad.
Now, don't say that. You're just ill, and I'll nurse you back to health. Oh, Frank, this is your wife talking. What sort of spineless thing do you suppose you've married? What would you have me do? Run to the police and ask them to protect me from my husband? Run to the police and cry that the man I love wants to kill me? Run to the police and
kill him? That's right. Of course. Why didn't I think of that before?
No, Frank. Frank, what are you going to do?
Have a seat, Mrs. Clark.
What is it you want of me, Inspector Wade? Why was I called here to the police station?
You've no idea?
No. Oh. Is he here, my husband? He told you?
But I thought he was just drunk.
Oh, I told him not to come here. I told him not to.
Then it's all true?
Yes.
This beats anything I've ever heard. Man loves wife so much, he wants to strangle her. Kisses her. Gets an irresistible yen to choke her to death. And on their honeymoon. You want to prefer charges?
Prefer charges? What for?
Well, attempted homicide ought to cover it.
I won't. He's my husband. I love him. I'll stick by him no matter what.
But he ought to at least be sent to Bellevue for a mental...
Oh, no, you won't. There's nothing mentally wrong with Frank. Nothing at all. It's simply nerves, the result of an accident he had recently.
This really takes the cake. Mrs. Clark, another thing that puzzles me.
Yes?
He kept raving about a line when he staggered in here. As if it were life or death. A line of poetry he couldn't remember. Wanted me to tell him what it was. Confidentially, I've only read one poem in my life. Now, what's that all about?
I haven't the vaguest notion, Inspector. Just part of his neurotic state, I suppose. When we get back to our hotel room...
What? You want him back after what happened?
Yes. Don't you see, I must cure him of that awful obsession. Who else can do it but me? I'd like to see him now, Inspector. Please release him to me. I'll take the consequences.
He's not here.
Not here?
No. We held him overnight just to let him sober up like we would any other drunk. Thought it was just all boozy eyewash. Well, this morning he seemed a new man and laughed it all off. So we released him. Just a few minutes ago.
Oh, wonderful.
But then I had a hunch. I ought to warn you anyway. Just a hunch.
Warn me?
Yeah. He said he was going to call on you tonight at the hotel for a little reunion.
Oh, how marvelous. Maybe he's all cured.
I don't know. I didn't like the way he smiled when he said it. Mrs. Clark, after what you just told me, I think I ought to have him picked up again.
You'll do no such thing.
It's taking your life in your hands. I think he's got wheels in his head.
I don't care. I love him.
You die just as dead when you're in love.
I'm not afraid. I'll never leave him. Certainly not now when he needs me more than ever. Is that all, Inspector?
Okay, lady. You're 14 carat. He sure doesn't deserve a wife like you. And don't say I didn't warn you. It's your funeral.
Thank you, Inspector. Goodbye.
Oh, Mrs. Clark, there's one more thing perhaps I ought to tell you.
Yes?
When I released him just a while ago, he said something else that puzzled me. That being in jail had suddenly given him revelation. He smiled very queerly when he said it.
Oh?
I think maybe he found that line of poetry, Mrs. Clark.
Hello?
Ruth?
Where are you, Frank?
In the lobby.
Come up.
I don't know exactly what your game is, my sweet bride, but I'm warning you. I've had a revelation.
I know. It's high time.
I'm going to finish it, Ruth, this time. You asked for it.
Come up, Frank.
Sure?
Sure.
Your funeral.
A coward does it with a kiss. Come in, Frank. The door's open.
Throwing a party, my dear?
Yes.
Who's invited?
You and I.
What are we celebrating?
An uninvited guest at our honeymoon. Death has come with you, hasn't it, this time?
Yes.
Shall we drink to him?
Why not?
Do you still love me, Frank?
Yes, I still love you. But I'll love you better when you're dead for what you've done.
How much do you know?
Not enough. It came to me in jail last night. The jail had something to do with it. How, I still don't know, but enough to make me remember something you whispered in the hospital when I was just coming to. You said, I'll get my revenge, Frank. Do you hear me? I'll get my revenge.
Splendid. A from memory. What else?
Enough to make me realize that you hate me and have always hated me, although you pretended otherwise.
Brilliant. Say loved and hated you. Go on.
And that somehow, I don't know myself in what way, but I'm sure it must be a very clever way, as your psychology students would agree. You've been coldly, deliberately torturing me, trying to make me think myself a maniac, or have others think so.
Close enough.
Why, what I can't understand is why you did it, or why you weren't afraid that I'd really murder you.
You'll soon find out.
And I'm convinced now that you've done it all with a single line. A single line of poetry. In my jail cell, I was sure of it. The very walls seemed to tell me, I don't know why, that it was a line that you kept reading to me at the hospital, over and over and over again, that made me think I wanted to kill you.
And what was that line?
That's what I'm going to find out, right now.
Don't come any closer, Professor.
You know, it's perfectly ridiculous looking at you now, close to you where I can almost touch you. That crazy obsession is still with me. I laugh at it intellectually. I know that you've tricked me into it by some very obvious power of suggestion, but I still feel that way.
Don't come any nearer. I'm warning you.
Isn't it eerie? I still love you and can strangle you for my love. And will.
Stay where you are. You're not going to kill me, darling. I'm going to kill you. Now do you see why I wasn't afraid of you?
That gun. You've had it all the time.
Correct, my love. Right here in the wine table drawer. I've planned this all along, Angel, from the very first. Before we were even married. Yes, your intuition was right. From the day you and my little sister were brought to the hospital after the accident. From the day she died, and the doctor said you'd pull through. I planned it all. And it's worked out like a perfect equation every step of the way.
Why? Why?
I had to commit the perfect crime, and I've done it. Even the police will testify that it was self-defense against a homicidal maniac. And when they find you here with a bullet in your head, they'll congratulate me.
But what's this all? I still don't
understand. It had to be the perfect crime because I must go free. You see, one life has already paid for yours. And quart for quart, your blood is worth no more than my family's.
I don't understand this at all. What did I ever do?
You killed my sister.
I killed her?
She told me before she left on that drive with you that she was going to crash the car. She left before I could stop her. She told me everything, Frank, including what you'd done to her.
Everything. I see. So that's it. Well, I don't suppose it would be of any use my trying to convince
her. No use. I've waited a long time for this moment. Revenge is sweet. And it was such fun to torture you. I used a weapon I knew. Of course, it was power of suggestion. Sure, you guessed it. But what a pity you don't know the line yet.
What was it? What was it? Tell me. Tell me. Don't keep me in torture.
Keep back. Think hard, Frank. Think all around it. What about a jail and the revelation it gave you? What about a famous poet who wrote a famous poem while in jail?
Why?
Yes, yes.
Oscar Wilde. That's it. Yes, that's it from Oscar Wilde. A ballad.
Of course, a ballad.
The Ballad of Reading Jail. How could it ever have escaped me? Why, you witch, you've even been reading from it on our honeymoon. But what part? What verse? What line? What was the line?
Don't take another step or I'll pull the trigger.
Give me the line, I say. I still can't think of the line.
Keep back or I'll shoot.
Oh, no, you won't.
One more step and I'll shoot.
Tell me that line or I'll kill you.
All men kill the thing they love. Remember, Frank?
How's the next line go, Mrs. Clark? By all, let this be heard. So I heard. Too bad I was a little late.
Inspector Wade.
You know, ma'am, like I said, I only read one poem in my whole life. But ain't it the darndest thing? It happened to be the Ballad of Reading Jail.
honeymoon in the bridal suite. Red wine spilled on the table, and red blood on the floor as the clock strikes 12 for murder at midnight. Be with us again when death's key turns in the lock and the clocks strike 12 for murder at midnight. The part of Professor Ruth Clark was played by Elspeth Eric. Professor Frank Clark by Eric Dressler. With music by Charles Paul, Murder at Midnight was directed by Anton M. Leder.
Take a break in a minute, but before we do that, we're going to hear a very short story from the LibriVox project, The Man Tiger. It's identified as being anonymous and seems to be a retelling of a traditional story. Kind of sounds like India to me. And then we'll get directly into the spawn of the subhuman. If nothing else, you've got to admire that title. Spawn of the Subhuman. It'll be a dark fantasy. From February the 22nd of 1942.
The Man Tiger by Anonymous. There was once a young man who, when a boy, had learnt witchcraft from some girlfriends. He was married, but his wife knew nothing about this. They lived happily together and were in the habit of paying frequent visits to the wife's parents. One day they were on their way together to pay such a visit, and in passing through some jungle they saw, grazing with a herd of cattle, a very fine and fat bull calf. The man stopped and stripped himself to his waistcloth and told his wife to hold his clothes for him while he went and ate the calf that had stirred his appetite. His wife, in astonishment, asked him how he was going to eat a living animal. He answered that he was going to turn into a tiger and kill the animal, and he impressed on her that she must on no account be frightened or run away. And he handed her a piece of root and told her that she must give it to him to smell when he came back, and he would once again regain his human shape. So saying, he retired into a thicket and took off his waistcloth and at once became a tiger. Then he swallowed the waistcloth and thereby grew a fine long tail. Then he sprang upon the calf and knocked it over and began to suck its blood. At this sight, his wife was overwhelmed with terror, and forgetting everything in her fear, ran right off to her father's house, taking with her her husband's clothes and the magic root. She arrived breathless and told her parents all that had happened. Meanwhile, her husband had been deprived of the means of regaining his own form and was forced to spend the day hiding in the jungle as a tiger. When night fell, he made his way to the village where his father-in-law lived. But when he got there, all the dogs began to bark, and when the villagers saw that there was a tiger, they barricaded themselves in their houses. The man-tiger went prowling round his father-in-law's house, and at last his father-in-law plucked up courage and went out and threw the root which the wife had brought under the tiger's nose, and he at once became a man again. Then they brought him into the house and washed his feet, and gave him hot rice water to drink, and on drinking this he vomited up lumps of clotted blood. The next morning the father-in-law called the villagers and showed them this blood and told them all that had happened. Then he turned to his son-in-law and told him to take himself off, and vowed that his daughter should never go near him again. The man-tiger had no answer to make, but went back silently and alone to his own home. The End of Man-Tiger by Anonymous.
to see. Spawn of the subhuman.
Beautiful takeoff.
Yes, good pilot. But why did you charter such a large plane for just the two of us, Michael? Isn't this being just a bit too pretentious?
Nothing but the best from now on, Adela. Besides, this was the only plane available. You can unloosen your safety belt now.
I might as well confess that the real reason I was late was because I took so much time reading the notices in the paper this morning.
Weren't they superb?
Excellent. The audience was quite nice to me last night. Extremely appreciative, but I didn't expect such fine reports from the press.
Didn't I tell you before the concert that you'd be a hit? Today, my dear, you're recognized as the outstanding soprano of the nation.
You've had a lot of faith in me, haven't you, Michael?
Well, offhand, I'd say I have, yes.
You spent a lot of money to make me a success.
Don't worry. I'll collect every cent of it back if we get as good houses as we had last night.
Michael.
Yes, darling?
Do you feel, well, rather strange?
Strange? No, dear, why?
I feel like something is going to happen.
What makes you say that?
I don't know. A feeling of impending danger just seemed to come over me all of a sudden.
Danger? What possible danger could we be in?
I don't know. But I've had this feeling before. It's like someone had spread a shroud down over this airplane.
Oh, now that's a peculiar way to talk, Adela.
It's the same sort of feeling I had that day Stefan disappeared.
Stefan Wilder?
Yes.
Adela.
I was riding in my car that day. I'd been to a matinee with several of my friends. We'd had a glorious time. I was quite happy. So I drove out into the country with the top down on my car. The wind was blowing against the car, just as it's blowing against the plane now. And the sun was glistening on the bright metal of the car, just as it's glistening on the wing out there.
Darling, please don't think of that now.
Oh, it was a lovely day, just like today. My heart was very light. I was happy, thrillingly happy. Stefan and I were to be married within a week.
Adela, please.
And then, for no reason at all, I had that strange feeling. It just came out of nowhere and settled down around me like a huge cloth might cover the body of someone who had just died.
Don't talk that way, darling.
It was the strangest feeling I'd ever experienced. Weird. Terrible. It gave me the feeling that 100,000 evil spirits were racing at a maddening pace behind my car, trying to catch up with me, clutch me in their bony, fiendish hands.
That was so long ago. 5 years.
So long ago. It seems like yesterday. Then, when I speeded up the car, something began to pound in my ears. It's pounding there now, Michael. It's pounding there now.
Adela, please.
The faster I drove, the more that evil shroud hung over me. I gave the car more gas. More, more, more. And then,
when they found you in the wreckage, they thought you were dead.
I couldn't make the curve. The motor had reached full speed. I could think of but one single danger. The invisible danger that raced there behind me, striving to catch me in its hold.
But there was no one, nothing.
Oh, but there seemed to be. And what was so strange, all of a sudden that bright day vanished. Just vanished. Clouds came out of nowhere and hid the sun from sight.
Darling, I better pull down the shade on the window.
Oh, Michael, wait a minute. Look. Look outside. Clouds. We're flying below them. And they've completely blotted out the sun.
The sun will be out in a minute.
Oh, It's just like that day. Clouds hiding the sun. Just like they did that day.
Oh, just a coincidence.
Dark, dreary clouds. Followed by loud bursts of thunder. Listen. Oh, Michael. What does it mean?
Nothing. Nothing at all. Just a thunderstorm. Pilot will go up and fly above it.
Why didn't he go up above the storm when he saw it?
Oh, I don't know.
Because he didn't see it, that's why.
Certainly he did.
No. Oh, it came up. Just like that day 5 years ago. Out of nowhere. It came up before the pilot was even aware of it.
Oh, nonsense.
It wasn't nonsense 5 years ago. First clouds, then the thunder, then it began to rain.
Well, look for yourself. It's not raining now. It's nothing but an electrical storm. See, we're going above it.
Oh, Michael, I'm frightened.
There's nothing to be frightened about. There, look. There's the sun again.
It was all so strange. That feeling. The clouds hiding behind the sun. The thunder.
Sure, but no rain.
Mr. Brown?
Oh, Michael.
Darling, just the pilot talking to us over the talkback system. Push that button right there so I can answer him.
Mr. Brown, Miss Rhodes.
Yes, pilot, what is it?
Don't be alarmed about the storm. We're above it now.
Oh, yes, thank you. Just an electrical storm, isn't it?
No, sir. It's more than that. It's raining cats and dogs down there.
Michael. Rain. Oh, Michael.
We're up above the storm. Nothing can harm us here.
You remember, don't you? I never saw Stephen Wilder again after that experience I had 5 years ago.
Yes. Yes, I remember.
No one ever saw him again. He just disappeared.
Please, darling, don't think about it anymore today. You're tired. Perhaps a little rest would do you good.
Oh, yes, you're right. I am tired.
Just lie back and relax, then. Honestly, sweet, there's nothing to be worried about. We just happened to run into a storm when you thought about that old experience of yours.
I wonder, Michael. I wonder if we did just happen into the storm. Where are you, darling?
Over here, dear. Did you have a good sleep?
Oh, I did sleep after all. Why are the lights out?
Oh, I turned them out so you'd sleep as long as you could. And I'll switch them back on. There.
What time is it?
9:30.
9:30? Oh, Michael, I've been asleep more than 8 hours.
I thought you'd never wake up.
It's after dark, and you've had the lights off all this time just for me.
Well, I guess I'd better admit I got a little sleep, too.
Where are we now?
Over Mexico. Hey, hungry, dear?
Oh, I'm famished. You know, I can't imagine what made me sleep so long.
We land at Centella. We can get food there.
Have we landed at all since I retired?
No, we're circling now. Well, that's Centella down there. Oh. They better pretty up a bit. This is a secluded part of the country, but you never know who you're going to run into. Centella.
How long before we're in Monterey?
Oh, about an hour.
Did you get good reservations?
The best. Did you enjoy your dinner?
Oh, immensely. That was a nice place. Certainly a rough landing field, though.
Well, it's not actually a landing field. We had to land someplace to refuel before we got to Monterey, so I picked Centella.
I enjoyed it. A quaint little place. Hmm. It's a funny thing, Michael. Did you notice the plane?
What do you mean, dear?
Didn't look a bit like it had been in a rainstorm.
I thought you'd forgotten all about that. Of course it didn't look like it. We flew above the rain before it started.
Oh, yes, that's right. Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to spend the next hour looking through my fashion magazines before we land at Monterey.
Yes?
Should we be over water?
Water? Well, no, of course not.
Well, we are. There's water all around us.
Well, let's see. By heaven, Adelaide, you're right.
The pilot's off his course.
Surely you must realize it.
Oh, you better go up and find out.
Yes, I will. I'll be right back.
Hurry, Michael, for heaven's sake.
Right. Door to the pilot's cabin's locked. I say, pilot. Pilot.
What's wrong, Michael?
Oh, the door to this cabin is locked. Curtain over the windows pulled down inside. Pilot, open up.
Look, he's raising the curtain. Michael.
Good Lord. A thick, hairy arm.
Michael, that's not our pilot at the controls. It's a monkey.
A gorilla.
Oh, Michael. Are we dreaming?
No, it's true. A live gorilla piloting our plane.
But that's impossible.
No, confounded door's locked. Open this door. Open up.
Michael, be careful. Look at him. Peering back at us with little beady eyes. And an expression on his face that almost human.
This is fantastic. How in the world did we ever come to be in the air with a creature like that?
We had our regular pilot when we landed at Centella. I saw him climb down out of the cabin.
So did I. But I never did see him again before we took off. Naturally, his back was to me when I gave him the go-ahead signal.
Oh, Michael, now what?
Oh, we're over land. He's bringing the plane down.
Oh, Michael. We're on the ground.
An absolutely perfect landing.
He's unlocking the door now. Michael, what's he going to do?
Just take it easy. Don't get excited. Whatever you do, don't run or make a fast movement. Don't let him know you're afraid of him.
Just standing there, looking at us.
Whatever you do, don't let him know you're afraid of him.
You don't have to be afraid of me.
Michael.
That creature talked.
Of course I talk.
Oh, we're a couple of fools, Adela. Just our pilot playing a trick on us, dressed up in a monkey suit.
There is no trickery. I am not your original pilot.
What?
I joined you at Centella, where I came to meet you for Dr. Luther.
Dr. Luther?
Yes. He's waiting for you. Come, follow me.
Steady, darling. Come on. We'd better follow him.
Here's the doctor now.
Well, Stephen, I see you brought our visitors.
Yes, doctor.
Yes, just as I directed you. Welcome, Adela Rhodes, and welcome to your lovely, lovely voice.
I say, look here.
And welcome to you, Mr. Brock. I'm so sorry that you will be of no assistance to me. However, you may be interested in what I have planned.
Now listen, Dr. Luther, I want to know what this is all about.
You will learn what it is all about, and without delay, I assure you. Come, Stephen, don't be so inhospitable. Show our guest into the laboratory. Sit down over there, my dear. Over here, Mr. Brock.
Michael.
Dr. Luther, I demand an explanation. Where are we? Why have you brought us here?
You're too full of questions, Mr. Brock. I've already told you I'm about to show you why I brought you here. Here, high in these mountains, secretly, I've been working for 5 years, experimenting, testing, trying to accomplish what everyone would have said was utterly impossible had I told them about it. But I didn't tell anyone. Instead, I came here and built this laboratory. You see, it's fully equipped and modern in every detail.
Oh, look here, Dr. Luther.
During those 5 years, I trained Stephen here. I believe you will agree my training has been very successful. You now see an almost full-grown gorilla, behaving like a human, acting like a human, even talking like a human. I've been very kind to you, haven't I, Stephen?
Yes, Dr. Luther. Of course you've been kind.
Yes, just so. Scientist back there in your world, my dear Miss Rhodes, will tell you it's impossible to completely train a gorilla. That is the second point in which I've proved them wrong. Stephen, sing for us.
Yes, Doctor.
può, si può, signore, signori.
Doesn't he have an excellent voice?
Michael, did you hear that?
Impossible. Sing again, Stephen.
Oh,
you see, soon he will be world famous. I shall travel with him, take him to the four corners of the earth, and show people how well my gorilla sings.
Oh, Michael, I can't believe it. That's Stephen Wilder's voice.
It can't be. Ah, but it is.
Yes. Now I remember. Now I know who you are, Dr. Luther. Stephen Wilder had an appointment with you that day he disappeared 5 years ago. I'd forgotten all about it, but I just now remembered.
So that's what happened to Stephen Wilder. You kidnapped him and brought him here and... You.
Precisely. I brought him here to do what others said could never be done. When I chloroformed him 5 years ago and brought him here, I thought I was ready. But my gorilla wasn't. So I had to wait. 3 months ago, I performed the operation.
Operation?
I removed the vocal cords from the man and grafted them into the gorilla.
Oh.
This is ridiculous. A thing like that can't be done.
Oh, surely you don't deny the proof I've just given you, Mr. Brock. Stephen, sing.
Oh.
You recognized that voice, Miss Rhodes, the moment you heard it. Because you'd sung operas with Mr. Wilder so much.
That was the way he sang, to exercise his voice.
Don't you both realize what I have here? The secret of an untold wealth. Why, besides knowing how to train this ferocious and morose type of animal, besides knowing how to transfer human vocal cords successfully, I have something I can exhibit to the world to prove my knowledge. Think of the fortune I can amass, because people will pay immense sums to see and hear my singing gorilla.
Stop it. Stop it, I say. Why have you brought me here? Surely you could have spared me this.
I will tell you why, Miss Rhodes. If you and Mr. Brock will step over here.
The only place we're going to step is out of this place.
We'll do as I ask. Stephen, these people are not to leave.
Very well, Dr. Luther.
Over here, if you please.
Better do what he says, Adela.
There. Go through this plate glass. Look into the next room.
Another gorilla.
Yes. Isn't it a fine specimen?
Fine specimen?
Yes, she.
She?
No. You're not planning.
I've trained her very carefully. She was so much more responsive than the male. Now that she's able to obey me, I'm quite ready for the rest of my plans for her.
Oh, no. No, you can't. I won't let you.
I'll say you can't.
Neither of you will be able to prevent it. Soon I'll tour the world with the most amazing exhibition on earth. A male and a female gorilla singing all the world famous operas.
Look here, you...
Wait a minute. I just happened to think of something, Doctor.
Yes?
Do you remember the day Stephen Wilder had that appointment with you 5 years ago?
Yes, certainly I remember. I'd been planning to obtain possession of him so I could bring him here. I was most pleased when he called and asked for an appointment.
But did he tell you why he was calling upon you?
I know. No, he didn't.
He came to you, Dr. Luther, because he was losing his voice.
You must be wrong.
I am not wrong. I am the only one he told about it. It had been worrying him for a long time. You see, the more he sang, the worse his voice became. He was gradually losing it.
But that's impossible.
Do you think so, Doctor? You're a specialist on that subject. That's why he was coming to you that
day. No, you must be wrong. After all the work I've done.
Your gorilla will lose his voice, Dr. Luther. And I assure you, before you'll do anything to me, I'll see to it that my voice is ruined, too.
He won't! He can't! He's an excellent voice, excellent! Yes, yes, of course he is. We've worked together, I've trained him. His voice can't go bad on me now. Not now! Just when it's finally successful.
Oh, you'll see, Dr. Luther.
No, you're wrong. You're mistaken. He'll sing all right. He won't lose his voice. Will you step in? No, of course not. You're in an excellent voice, Stephen. Sing. Sing, go ahead, Stephen. Show him.
Si può, si può. Signore, signore.
There, you see? Did you hear that? A beautiful quality. Beautiful tones.
Amore.
Listen, Doctor.
Stephen! What's wrong? Try again.
Oh, my!
Now you think I'm wrong.
So, it's true. Stephen, you devil! After all I've done, after all my work, this is what I get as a reward. I sacrificed everything. My position, my career, all my money, and this is what happens. Well, there's one way, Stephen. Thy heaven has one way.
Get back, Adela.
He got a gun.
No, no, Dr. Luther. That would have hit that beast, but look at him.
Stop! No! No, Stephen! Stephen, no, no!
You have heard Spawn of the Subhuman, tonight's original tale of dark fantasy by Scott Bishop. Ben Morris was heard as Michael Brock. Eleanor Naylor Corrin was Adler Rhodes. Garland Moss played Dr. Luther, and Muir Height was the gorilla. Next Friday night at this same time, listen to the 16th in this series of dark fantasy dramas created by Scott Bishop, The Man with the Scarlet Satchel. The story of an aged millionaire who receives a child's set of modeling clay as a practical joke, but who turns the gift into an incredible and weird instrument of destruction. Don't miss this unusual story next Friday night, The Man with the Scarlet Satchel. Tom Paxton speaking. Dark Fantasy comes to you from WKY, Oklahoma City. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
You know, I really figured out that there was going to be trouble when we discovered that they had a gorilla for a pilot. It's also when I decided this is going to be kind of fun. Calling Dr. Frankenstein, calling Dr. Frankenstein. Dr. Moreau? Paging Dr. Moreau, paging Dr. Moreau. Anyone see Dr. Moreau around here? Well, I think we have just about enough time now for a 5-minute mystery.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Another step.
You go on alone and I'll wait here.
Nothing doing.
Oh, Sheriff! Sheriff, please!
Hey, somebody calling me.
That man there, Henry. Come in this way.
Oh, Sheriff! Oh, gee, I'm mighty glad I found you, sir.
Hey, what's the matter, Rube? Something wrong?
Johnny Clare, the star aerialist over in the Big Top. She was just found murdered in her tent.
Now let's get this straight. Cause of death, strangulation. Grease paint smears on her throat and several small fresh scratches on the palms of her hands. Costume also grease smeared.
Well, what do you say, Sheriff? We can't keep the crowd waiting in the Big Top all day.
As company manager, what do you think? It's kind of upset your show, doesn't it?
Why don't you talk to the voodoo doctor? He was the last one with her.
Might be a good idea. Which one's he?
Well, he's right over there, Sheriff, the one in all the paint.
Ah, so you're the voodoo doctor?
Yes, sir, I am.
What's your name? What do I call you besides voodoo doctor?
Just call me Neil.
Urban here tells me that you might be able to throw some light on the murder of Miss Clare.
Urban, eh? I thought so. Why, you...
No rough stuff, eh? Now talk, Neil. Don't feel like it. Well, Urban, suppose you tell me what you know.
Well, Sheriff, just before the show started, I saw the voodoo doctor sneak away from Dottie's tent.
Dressed just as he is in costume.
Yeah, grease from head to foot. I waited until he passed and then looked into Dottie's tent. She was dead.
And you think that Neil, the voodoo doctor...
killed Dottie? I'm sure of it. I heard him threaten her.
That's a lie. Dottie asked me to come to her tent, but she was dead when I got there.
Did you touch anything?
Not a thing. I'm not so crazy as to leave fingerprints on somebody else's dirty work.
Does everyone in the show use the same grease paint that you have on, Neil?
No, I'm the only one. As a voodoo, I have to paint up like this.
Well, if you and Urban were the only humans to be near the body before she was murdered...
And he's your man, Sheriff.
I don't think so, Urban. I think you're in for a little surprise. You see, I'm holding you for the murder of Dottie Clare.
Why did the sheriff arrest Urban, the show's manager, for the murder of his aerialist? In a moment, we'll hear, but first... story.
You're crazy, Sheriff. You ain't got one piece of evidence against me.
Haven't I, though? Listen, you claim it was Neil that came out of the tent after Dottie Clare was murdered. Neil's torso and his face and hands are covered with grease paint.
It's all over the dead girl's costume, too, ain't it? What more could you want?
Just something you overlooked, Urban. Anyone struggling with him would have grease paint all over his own hands, too. But the only marks on Dottie's hands were scratches. This is proof enough that Dottie Clare did not struggle with your voodoo man, as you said. And consequently... he couldn't have strangled her. Oh, Urban, looks like you slipped up that time. And that slip is going to cost you your life.
Next is a play from July the 17th of 1945 by the famous Norman Corwin. I'm really up against the clock today, so I'm not going to say much about this, except that it is The Undecided Molecule, which is basically about a molecule that has commitment problems. It stars, well, I'll let the man tell you who it stars. I will have a good deal more about Corwin after the next break.
Lucky you. You happened to dial this program in time to attend a trial stranger than any since we first learned the knack of breathing. And that was a long time back. The poor folks listening to other stations will lose all this. But congratulations to you for being no such fool as to miss the undecided molecule.
Columbia presents Corwin. Tonight, in the third of a limited series of eight broadcasts for CBS, Norman Corwin brings you The Undecided Molecule, a rhymed fantasy concerning dangerous developments among the elements, as disclosed by Robert Benchley, Norman Lloyd, Groucho Marx, Vincent Price, Sylvia Sidney, Keenan Wynn, and the music of Carmen Dragon, conducted by Lud Gluskin. The Undecided Molecule.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. The cosmic alarm, which means I fear some woeful harm is afoot or a wing in the universe. Some deplorable thing. Some active curse. Like a falling sky. Or a new star cluster been banged up by a cluster buster. Sounds to me like a dried up sea. Or another ice age for a spell. Nor maybe it's only a freezing hell. On the other hand, it might possibly be that Hitler is alive and well. But after all, there's no point guessing. If it rings again in a manner pressing, I'll answer the interstellar phone. I wish they'd leave a feller alone. My only last eon. Hello, hello. Yes, this is he. What? Who? What's that? Say that again. But where? But how? But why? But when? Individually and solely? Now, wait a minute. Take it slowly. It did. Oh, no. Oh, no. Not that. Holy jumping Jehoshaphat. I'll call a session right away. You bet. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, grunt. Oh, moon. Oh, damn it. We are faced with a calamity. I must be cool as liquid air. Hold on. Who's that? Who's pulling my hair? Why, it is I. What am I scary at? Nonsense. I'll phone the secretariat. Oh, dear, I am in such a tizzy. The obvious rhyme, the line is busy. I'll try again. There's no harm trying. Oh, I'm dying, Egypt. Dying. Hello. Say, this is the fifth VP in charge of physiochemistry. Now, listen here. An especially perky molecule has gone berserk. It has refused to be confined, incorporated, or assigned to anything. It simply sits with a calm expression, and it knits. Now, by all means, we must prevent such an utterly dangerous precedent. One holdout molecule, unpent, can cause the cosmos great ferment. We must arraign this beast and try it. The charge? Inciting particles to riot. Okay, arrange. I mean arraign. I mean all three. I mean the twain. No, never mind. Just get it booked. Or else the universe is cooked. Oh, me, oh, my. Goodbye, goodbye.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Court of Arbitrations and Adjudications of Physiochemical Relations, Department of the Interior of the Atom, Criminal Sitting, Division of Investigation, Charge, Countercharge, Accusation and Confession... is now in session. The court will rise and face the justice who will adjust this case. See that your concentration centers on his honor, the justice, just as he enters. Which he is doing even now. Everybody bow! Everybody bow!
To it. Contrary notwithstanding, you may sit. Blake,
Read the charge.
May it please the court at all to wit.
It pleases the court. Get on with it. Whose voice is whom?
The cosmos and all the spheres, systems, clusters, galaxies, orbits, planets, satellites, together with all species of animals, vegetables, and minerals appertaining thereto, of all conditions of age, social standing, and sex, versus the anonymous molecule hereinafter referred to as X.
What's the charge against said molecule?
Unwilling to be named, rebelling when defined, declining to be blamed, objecting when assigned, protesting when selected, resisting an attack, refusing to be directed, and talking back.
Most serious, most dangerous, so strange, it's almost strangerous, insidious, precarious, a shade below nefarious. The possibilities in sight are frightful, meaning full of fright, and rueful, meaning full of rue, and gruesome, meaning rather grue.
Providing, Your Honor, the charges are true.
Oh, why, yes, they must be proven true.
Which is something we have yet to do.
Quite right, but who was asking you? Now, is the prosecutor here?
Present.
Well, then, appear. The trial's on. Try not to miss it. Step up and state your case and be explicit.
May it please the court, this case involves a very small matter. By this, I don't mean mere trivia or idle chatter, but a particle of matter best described as little.
Smaller than a jot?
Even smaller than a tittle.
Are you referring to molecule X?
Yes.
Then why don't you say so?
I will, if I may so. The point, Your Honor, is that should X be acquitted here, catastrophe will follow, since it must then be admitted here that all control of elements has given away to anarchy, and every substance will perforce be jittery and panicky. Thus, when we wish a molecule to join up with some other, to make a cup or a lemon drop for the Karamazov brothers, to be a fog or a catalog, or a lawn to be idyllic on, a beagle or a bagel, or a mountain made of silicon, they may refrain, they may desist, and if enough of them should do so, there'll never be another tenor singer like Caruso. No dog to bark, no lark to hawk, no grand old man like Talleyrand. No bee will be, you'll see no sea, no ostrich fan for Sallyrand.
It's staggering. It's awesome, the damage X could wreak. By simply playing possum, it makes me rather weak. Clerk, order me a pony of spirits of ammonia.
Now there you are. If X's rebellion is indulged, I think it only safe to say, and fair to be divulged, there'll never be another atom of the element ammonium. So take that home and play it on Your Honor's own euphonium.
Young man, I blasted you a disapproving snort and warn you. One more phrase like that. Contempt of court. Now, who is here for the defense?
I am, Your Honor.
Well, commence.
I will. I do so. Now you see, sir.
I see nothing of the sort. Who's paying you your fee, sir?
No one at all. The way it is with me, sir, I'm acting out of interest in civil liberty, sir.
What's liberty to do with it, if you will be so kind?
Just this. Where in the universal law books can you find it's criminal for anything to be of open mind?
The precedent is ample.
It is. Let's have a sample.
Blackstone on the elements. Case of bismuth versus molybdenum.
Oh, drat the books. Our legal forebears doubtlessly all fibbed in them.
Hold on there, you. You upstart. Is not the horse before the cart? Where would we be without tradition?
In some advanced, improved position.
What? What? Young man, are you a red? Have you been to the crimson bread?
Neither to crimson nor to purple.
Well, no whipper-snapping twiple. Challenge me. What do you take me for?
A most distinguished expert on the law.
First sensible thing you've said today. Where were we in this trial, by the way?
On the right of X to have an open mind. Now, surely justice is not yet so blind as to be unfavorably disposed.
God's openness of mind, my mind is closed.
Your Honor, this is scandal.
Now, see here, I can handle this. Let's not have no more of your bold to-do. A molecule must do what it is told to do. Now, that's decided. Suppose we break for lunch. I'm famished. Been a tiring day. I sure would like to crunch. A nice fresh salad bowl of crispy, tangy hashish.
Your Honor, I cannot refrain from calling you a fascist.
Contempt of court. Blake, find the counsel for defendant, please. He has the brass to charge the bench with having fascist tendencies. Ridiculous and ludicrous. Make it a heavy fine. How could I be a fascist? Why, I am so benign, I hardly ever beat my wife. My children bow before me. I'm much admired by rattlesnakes, and birds of prey adore me. I'm tender and I'm sensitive. An anti-insurrectionist. I wouldn't hurt a cobra. And I'm anti-vivisectionist.
I'm sure that's absolutely true, and that you're not the sort who would deny a prisoner his right to speak in court. Your might is mixed with mercy, and wisdom's interfused. So how about a word or two from X, who is accused?
Oh, very well. Since your appeal is to the better side of me, let no one say my conduct here is prejudiced or snide of me. We'll hear from X, but make it short. Where is the little dope?
Right here beneath this new electronic super microscope.
Swear him in.
Put your right hand on the atomic table and say as loud as you are able, I do solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and buzz was the muzzawala, buzzawala, hot set, fluga, bugle, putt, putt, scuffle, button, nothing but the truth. So help me I. Now testify.
What's that squeaking?
My client, speaking.
Well, how do you expect me to understand?
There's an interpreter at hand.
Where? I don't see any.
Right at your elbow.
Oh, yes. How do you do?
I'm very well, Bo.
Bo, aren't you getting a bit familiar?
I suppose I am, but please think nil of it.
Can you understand what the molecule says?
Yes. That's my business, isn't it?
A fake character.
Like a film by Disney.
Disney's not involved in this.
Why isn't he?
I don't know. Where does all this lead?
Nowhere.
Then please proceed. To interpret X for the court of Lex. Lex is Latin for law, I guess, which shows I too enjoy access to more than one tongue. I'm a giant intellect. Now let's hear your client.
Proceed if you will, Mr. Molecule. Let your story fairly leap from you.
Oh, come on. Come on, we're waiting now.
The court wants to hear a peep from you.
X says as follows. I cannot bring myself to be just anything that's asked of me. I cannot chide my inner soul. I must confide I've set a goal. I've thought it through and cannot bear to be shampoo for oily hair. My spirit sings, my fiber spiels of nobler things and high ideals. I'll fairly bust my heart within if I am just an onion skin. I worry some. What's drearier than to become bacteria? When I've tried hard to obey, my conscience cried, but hold, but stay. A worm for bait? I have my pride. I vacillate. I can't decide. Though Hamlet had a hard time, why, he wasn't so sad as little I. You see my lot?
Yes.
It's not for me to be or not, but what to be.
Mm-hmm.
My plight inside is bona fide. I can't decide. I can't decide.
I've never been so touched or moved. I sniffle and I blubber. I thought my heart was made of steel, but it is made of rubber. Poor little thing, tormented so by dreams of the eugenic.
Oh, fiddlesticks, this molecule is but a schizophrenic. How is it that in all the time since matter first appeared, each separate iota has loyally adhered to universal law without a solitary beef?
Beef?
Until this pipsqueak came along. Now suddenly there's grief. The heavens shake and earthquakes quake and oceans heave and slither. And dogs and cats and acrobats are in a frightful dither. A timid snip has lost its grip and whines of its neurosis. If you condone this freak, you'll reek of moral halitosis. I strongly urge your honor, purge X to its smallest decimal, or else the infinite will bow before the infinitesimal.
You're right. What was I thinking of to pity young Schlemiel? I thought my heart was fairly soft, but it is made of steel. I shall not spoil this molecule by sparing it the rod. And so I sentence it to die before a firing squad. Perhaps a little torture face, like singeing at the stake, and drops of water on the head. And for variety's sake, a little twist of the garrote, a slice of guillotine, and X shall mark the spot where X was boiled in Vaseline.
I ask this sentence be appealed.
Impossible. Your client's fate is sealed.
Ah, no. The court's decision is far from ineluctable. I must remind you, my good sir, that matter's indestructible.
Gadzooks, it is. I had forgot. We can't destroy a particle. It seems we're in the power of this clever young upstarticle.
The case is lost. I must withdraw. If punishment's not capital and X cannot be executed, I don't give a rapital. We can't imprison it, and we'd be in a most infernal stew with cosmic checks and balances eternally askew.
Oh, dear, Vesemir, Vesemir. What will become of all of us? This little jake and his strange quirk will surely be the fall of us.
Your Honor!
You mean me?
May I have a conference with you at the bench?
Why, of course. May I suggest a means by which disaster be evaded? My client is no pig-head and may likely be persuaded to join some element or other.
Mm. X is not a softy.
No.
It merely wishes to belong to something fairly lofty. Its point of view is forward. Its attitude is global. Its heart is set on being part of something
good and noble.
How righteous.
So I suggest you demonstrate, and this will never hurt you, that being this or that or t'other has a point of virtue.
Well, how do you propose we do it?
I have a plan. I was coming to it. Invite a representative of each important kingdom.
You mean like Dempsey for the ring or Artie Shaw for Swindon?
No, but you're warm.
A lion for the jungle or an eagle for all Wingdom?
Keep on. Remember, three of them and one for every kingdom.
Oh, I know. Animal and mineral and, I forget the third.
The vegetable kingdom.
Why, yes, of course. Absurd. That's splendid. We could get them here and each could make a pitch. And X could then make up its mind to which it wished to hitch. I'll call a recess in this trial while we round up a trio. Meanwhile, some music.
Plank? Yes, sir.
Can you sing Solo Mio?
No, but the court musicians would be very glad to play for you.
Where's the conductor?
I'm right here.
Is everything okay for you?
You bet. Shall I begin, Your Honor, with a prelude by Stravinsky or a toccata for the G-string by the famous brothers Minsky?
Have you anything around that Dmitri Shostakovich wrote?
Oh, yes. A Passacaglia, and I'm sure that you will love its note.
I've changed my mind. I'll have a slug of music by Lynn Murray. The one he calls Verklär der Nacht, One Chicken, Mitten Curry. Is that title correct?
Yeah, I fear it is.
Okay, then. Play it.
Here it is.
One, two. For the vegetable kingdom will rise and address the court concerning the advantages to molecule X of joining this classification. With handy allusions to paleontology, plant psychology, stems and flowers, roots and fruits, and outstanding examples of horticulture and botany, if he's got me.
I doubt that X shall ever see an atom lovely as a tree. Why, nothing has got quite the charm of the most ordinary palm, with coffee beans and turpentine, and grapes which make imported wine. And as for molds and types of fungus, we have some noted ones among us. Penicillin is a spore, noble beyond metaphor. Life is earnest, life is sweet, for the common sugar beet. Cotton, spinach, hemp and hop, one could really never stop singing vegetary praise for years and months and weeks and days.
Well, X says that trees are chopped for wood and that he sees no special good in being a beet which people eat. X says a palm, though fine in Maine, can come to harm in a hurricane. The grape's a curse, since drink is evil, and cotton is worse for the boll weevil. X does not wish to look for trouble. It's not his dish, the vegetable.
For a molecule that's supposed to be meek, the choosy Mr. X has a lot of cheek. Step down, vegetable. Let mineral speak.
The spokesman for the mineral kingdom will address the court concerning the advantages to molecule X of joining this classification. With allusions to metallurgy, gypsum, filiform silver, motor cars, nickel bars, pickle jars, and manganese. Please.
Now, the way that X can best ensure his choice of substance will endure is to stop his flapping about and settle down to being a respectable metal. Oh, fiddly-dee, fiddly-dum, yum-yum. Oh, boy, aluminum. If he likes the work of Byron, he can be the iron in irony.
That sounds to me like pure, unalloyed non sequitur.
If he wishes to be a worker, he can serve in a column of mercury. And if he'd rather be gay and giddysome, there's radium, uranium, iridium. Oh, tantalum, tungsten, talcum, tin, ipsy, pipsy, bittersen, gin, alpha, saxon, copper, tax, rax, and rax, parax, parax, merrily, barely, chiller by gin, triple, zinc, and tail. Team.
Oh, I beg that. Are these football yells necessary?
Yes, sir. Very.
Well, what do they mean?
Well, amphibolsphene and pyroxene, being amygdaloidally idiochromatic, may create a stalactitic static, affecting the skeletal speed.
Mm-hmm.
On this, the experts are fully agreed.
Mm. Well, that clears it up very well indeed. Proceed.
If X wants glamour, need he be told of silver, platinum, and gold? And the safest job on any planet is to be a nice, strong rock of granite. If he likes good cooking, that dinner will boil very nicely over mineral oil. Does he cry to be a wagon hitched to a star, then apply to be a Hollywood motor car? Oh, I could pour mineral oil before you forever and a day, if it wouldn't bore you.
Well, X says, says he, that any jury'll find mercury somewhat mercurial. Iron gets rusty, bare rocks too nude, talc is too dusty, oil is crude. The automobile is not his bent, one elliptical wheel means an accident. Gold you can keep. He simply balks at lying deep beneath Fort Knox.
I've never heard such utterly rash, hypercritical balderdash. If I weren't so stately and dignified, I'd take that molecule outside and bop him right in his little beezer. Who does he think he is, little Caesar? Ah! Let the animal kingdom present its spokesman. Come on! Where is the gent?
Right here, but Your Honor...
All right, begin.
It's a her.
Never mind, swear him in, swear him in.
Very well.
The spokesman for the animal kingdom, etc. Species of bird, bee, dog, flea, hen, man. Does solemnly swear, etc. In the name of the llama, new, orc, jock, kangaroo, slippery Dan, Charlie Chan, the common man, and so forth. That he or she will please go forth and testify to the legal cause.
Thank you. I'd gladly take the floor.
Rather pretty. Eh bien? Hello?
I could fascinate X with the mystery of our considerable natural history. I could tell him the fame of each colorful name.
Go on, I'm goose pimply and blistery.
I could tell of a bird named the Smew, and another eclipse, Urubu, of Tsigatai, Zo, and of Tsingle Ro.
And a fish that is called in canoe?
Quite true.
And a monkey that's called Wanderoo?
Quite true.
Oh, I just love to listen to you.
I could tell of the vinegaroon, the squacco, the guiduck, baboon, the antelope bongo, the crow known as Drongo.
Will you join me for lunch one day soon?
For the record, may I ask whether these names are real or fictionary?
Don't interrupt. They're all in your dictionary.
Now, the Kepakai has a whistle.
Of course.
Distinct from the Ling and Dick Sissel, the Zibu and Zivet, and Terek of Tibet.
I cling to your words like a thistle.
I urge X to join the toucan or some other nice animal clan, like the beautiful Kuti or charming Agouti.
But what of the species of man?
Oh, that's another subject entirely. I do not recommend that X get involved in the affairs of mankind.
Is that because you believe in the principle of matter over man's mind?
No, but being human would surely hex a sensitive molecule like X.
Just how do you mean, Queen?
Well, it's not so easy to be a common man, no matter how much you work and plan. It's still a neat trick to live the span commonly allotted to the common man. A wandering breeze will affect your pump. If not a measle, then a mump. You can pull a tendon, get roundly hissed, or have to depend on an analyst.
How true.
You can get ptomaine or be undersold. Then there's Franco-Spain.
Fui.
And the common cold. A review can stink. You can miss a guess or be told how to think by the yellow press.
Did I tell you I greatly admire your dress?
No. There's water on the knee and athlete's toes, the doctor's fee and the running nose, aching bursitises, rashes and rickets, colitis and worsitises, and parking tickets.
Not in this court.
You can get diabetes or caught in the rain.
Not in this court.
You can run out of Wheaties or into a train. You can get neurasthenia, a blizzard can chill you. Your wife can be menia, a dentist drill you. A plaintiff can sue you, a bite give malaria. If no lover woo you, alas, miseraria.
Great legal embroilments, just let me take care of you.
Thank you. A fascist will fight you. And then there is asthma. Vampires can bite you and whine on your plasma. You can be badly reared and flunk out in Latin, or tangle your beard in spaghetti au gratin.
It's fattening.
You can get a flat tire, drop teeth in the drain, or suffer a dire escutcheon stain. You can drown in the Dnieper or suffer the bends. You can wind up a leper and lose all your friends.
Hard to wind up a leper.
You can settle in Philly, or step in a pail, or feel willy-nilly and cease to inhale.
How morbid, depressing, in fact suicidal. By the way, have you ever an hour that's idle?
Your Honor, my client has something to say.
I could meet you, What's that about X again, eh?
He's ready, I said.
Well, let him go ahead.
X says as follows. I'm glad to know the awful truth. Man has such woe, forsooth, forsooth.
What philosophy.
Yet what he's done, proud hands can clap. He's beaten the Hun and Will the Jap. He flies the air just like a smew, And swims for fair like the Incanoe.
Yes, like the Incanoe.
He has a soul. He reads Descartes. Like me, his goal is a thing apart. He's learned to kill the harmful bug by serum pill and sulfur drug. He beats the band and goes to school to understand the molecule.
You're the rascal.
In face of odds, he makes his way. Gives birth to quads, builds TVA. Displays his charms, plays blindfold chess, listens to Brahms and CBS.
CBS, of course.
The common guy both thinks and feels. Nothing's too high for his ideals. Though it cost him sadly to put down Jerk.
Please.
He's not done badly. Look at his works. For all his pains, we owe him thanks. And I do gladly join his ranks. The human flock has golden fleece. Grace to its stock and lasting peace.
Oh, splendid. What a moving speech. I had thought X a worm, a leech. But now I see he's a regular fellow. He's twanged me so I quiver like jello. Oh, joy, oh, rapture, fields of clover.
Looks to me like trial's over.
Quite so. My dear X, forgive the digression, but I'm sure you'll be happy in your chosen profession. As for you, Miss Hanema, you are great. It's slightly extra legal, but have you a date for later in the evening? Do you like to dance? Have you any marked tendency toward romance?
I have. But what about the wife you seldom beat? And the children you have mentioned who grovel at your feet?
Ho, ho, ho! Mere rhetoric and figmentary frippery. The legal mind behaves this way. It's very smooth and slippery when arguing. I have no wife or any such a fixture.
In that case, I will marry you, as in a Class B picture. We'll create a happy ending, plus two children of each sex.
To be a part of one of them, shall we invite Friend X?
Magnificent idea, that. Is our future child agreed?
X says indeed, and asks you speed your visit to the Reverend so we can have a life to lead and bring this to a clever end.
Hooray, I thought you'd never end. Will the court musicians kindly advance to the mic and play a wedding dance? And then after that, please segue and sally into a sort of a kind of finale. 1, 2, 3.
You have been listening to The Undecided Molecule, a rhymed fantasy written and directed and produced by Norman Corwin for CBS as the third of eight programs in the series Columbia Presents Corwin. Carmen Dragon composed the music, Lud Gluskin conducted.
That gifted man, Robert Benchley, appeared as the interpreter for the molecule. And you can see me soon in the Paramount picture, Duffy's Tavern.
It was Norman Lloyd who did that wonderful work as the highly competent official clerk.
Quiet. Oliver Wendell Groucho Marx appeared as the judge. And I'm going to be together with my brothers on the stage and screen again in A Night in Casablanca. Some one of these nights. Good night.
Vincent Price as the prosecutor was convincing and smooth and even slick. And you can catch me soon in 20th Fox's Dragon Wit.
It was Sylvia Sidney who convinced the molecule that being a human being can be fun. And if you'd like to see more of me, I'm appearing in a new film entitled Blood on the Sun.
I, Keenan Wynn, in sound mind and body...
I object.
Performed as the counsel for the defense of molecule. And to give you an idea how versatile I am, I was also the spokesman for the vegetable mineral.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Oh, okay, we're going to take a quick break here now, but we'll be back real soon. Norman Corwin. What can I say about Norman Corwin? He is probably the grandmaster of the golden age of radio. He was born on May the 3rd of 1910 and is still alive. and currently a lecturer at the University of Southern California. Kind of amazing at 99, isn't it? Corwin has won the One World Award, 2 Peabody Medals, an Emmy, a Golden Globe, a DuPont Columbia Award. He was nominated for an Academy Award for writing the adaptation for Lust for Life in 1956. On May 12th of 1990, Corwin received an honorary doctorate from Lincoln College. In 1996, he received the Doctor of Humane Letters from the California Lutheran University. He was inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame in 1993 and was inducted into the Pacific Pioneer Broadcast Diamond Circle in 1994. And a documentary film on Corwin's life, A Note of Triumph, The Golden Age of Norman Corwin, won an Academy Award for Best Documentary in the Short Feature category in 2006. If you go to the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, you'll find links for a lot of this stuff, including the documentary on his life, A Note of Triumph. It's really worth checking out. I'd check it out if I were you. I mean, I checked it out and thought it was good enough to put up there. Coming up next is an adaptation for Sleep No More of Jack London's How to Build a Fire. It aired on February the 27th of 1957.
This is Nelson Olmsted. Sleep no more. Sleep no more. Turn down the lights. Sink back in your chair and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be, you will sleep no more. Good evening. This is Ben Grauer introducing tonight's tale of terror, told by Nelson Olmsted on the National Broadcasting Company's presentation of Sleep No More. The story of terror can be as simple as a sheeted ghost rattling chains. It can be a complex and hidden world of horror, lurking in such unholy dimensions as only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. Or it can be those terrible, fathomless shadows which lie buried deep in the primitive mind of civilized man. And for this evening, well, Nelson Olmsted, tell us about this evening's story.
Thank you, Ben. We're starting off tonight with a story of an author of real stature, Jack London. As you might suspect, it's the tale of the Yukon and of a man's fight against the awful powers of nature. It's called To Build a Fire. Day had broken cold and gray, exceedingly cold and gray. The man turned aside from the main Yukon trail and climbed the high earth bank, where a dim and little-traveled trail led eastward through the fat spruce timberland. It was a steep bank, and he paused for breath at the top, excusing the act to himself by looking at his watch. It was 9 o'clock. There was no hint of sun, though there wasn't a cloud in the sky. It was a clear day, and yet there seemed an intangible pall over the face of things, a subtle gloom that made the day dark. And this was due to the absence of the sun. This fact didn't worry the man. He was used to the lack of the sun. It had been days since he had seen it, and he knew that a few more days must pass before that cheerful orb, due south, would just peep above the skyline and dip immediately from view. The man flung a look back along the way he had come. The Yukon River lay a mile wide and hidden under 3 feet of ice. On top of this ice were as many feet of snow. It was all pure white, rolling in gentle undulations where the ice jams of the freeze-up had formed. All this The absence of the sun from the sky, the tremendous cold, the strangeness and weirdness of it all, made no impression on the man. It wasn't because he was long used to it. He was a newcomer in the land, a chichaco, and this was his first winter. The trouble with him was that he was without imagination. He was quick and alert in the things of life, but only in the things and not in the significances. 50 degrees below zero meant 80-odd degrees of frost. Such fact impressed him as being cold and uncomfortable, and that was all. 50 degrees below zero stood for a bite of frost that hurt and that must be guarded against by the use of mittens, ear flaps, warm moccasins, and thick socks. 50 degrees below zero was to him just precisely 50 degrees below zero. That there should be anything more to it than that was a thought that never entered his head. He plunged in among the big spruce trees. He was bound for the old claim in the left fork of Henderson Creek, where the boys were already. They had come over across the divide from the Indian Creek country, while he had come the roundabout way to take a look at the possibilities of getting out logs in the spring from the islands in the Yukon. He would be into camp by 6 o'clock. A bit after dark, it was true, but the boys would be there. A fire would be going, and a hot supper would be ready. The trail was faint. A foot of snow had fallen since the last sled had passed over, and he was glad he was without a sled, traveling light. He was surprised, however, at the cold. It certainly was cold, he concluded, as he rubbed his numb nose and cheekbones with his mittened hand. At the man's heels trotted a dog, a big native husky. The animal was depressed by the tremendous cold. It knew that it was no time for traveling. Its instinct told it a truer tale than was told to the man by the man's judgment. In reality, it wasn't merely colder than 50 below zero. It was colder than 60 below, then 70 below. It was 75 below zero. Since the freezing point is 32 above zero, it meant that 107 degrees of frost obtained. The man held steadily on. As he walked along, he rubbed his cheekbones and nose with the back of his mittened hand. He did this automatically, now and again changing hands. But rub as he would, the instant he stopped, his cheekbones went numb. And the following instant, the end of his nose went numb. He was sure to frost his cheeks, but it didn't matter much after all. What were frosted cheeks? A bit painful, that was all. They were never serious. Empty as the man's mind was of thoughts, he was keenly observant. Once coming around a bend, he shied abruptly like a startled horse, curved away from the place where he had been walking and retreated several paces back along the trail. The creek, he knew, was frozen clear to the bottom. No creek could contain water in that Arctic winter. But he knew also that there were springs that bubbled out from the hillsides and ran along under the snow and on top of the ice of the creek. He knew that the coldest snows never froze these springs. And he knew likewise their danger. They were traps. They hid pools of water under the snow that might be 3 inches deep or 3 feet. That was why he had shied in such panic. He had felt the ice give under his feet and heard the crackle of snow hidden ice skin. And to get his feet wet in such a temperature meant trouble and danger. At the very least, it meant delay, for he would be forced to stop and build a fire and under its protection to bare his feet while he dried his socks and moccasins. Once, when he arrived at the fork of the Henderson, he took off his mittens to unbutton his jacket and shirt to draw out his lunch. The action consumed no more than a quarter of a minute, yet in that brief moment the numbness laid hold of the exposed fingers. He didn't put the mitten on, but instead struck the fingers a dozen sharp smacks against the leg, and then he sat down on a snow-covered log to eat. The sting that followed upon the striking of his fingers against his legs ceased so quickly that he was startled. He pulled the mitten on hurriedly and stood up. He was a bit frightened. He stamped up and down until the stinging returned into the feet. It certainly was cold, was his thought. That man from Sulphur Creek had spoken the truth when telling how cold it sometimes got in the country. There was no mistake about it. It was cold. He built a fire to thaw himself out and then finished eating his lunch. When the man was through, he pulled on his mittens, settled the ear flaps of his cap firmly about his ears,
and took the creek trail up the left fork. The dog was disappointed and yearned back toward the fire. This man didn't know how cold it was. Possibly all the generations of his ancestry had been ignorant of cold, of real cold, of cold 107 degrees below freezing. But the dog knew, all its ancestry knew, and it had inherited the knowledge. There didn't seem to be so many springs in the left fork of the Henderson. For half an hour, the man saw no signs of any. And then it happened. At a place where there were no signs, where the soft, unbroken snow seemed to advertise solidity beneath, the man broke through. It wasn't deep, but he was wet halfway to the knees before he floated out to the firm crust. He was angry and cursed his luck aloud. He had hoped to get into camp with the boys at 6 o'clock, and this would delay him an hour, for he would have to build a fire to dry out his footgear. This was imperative at that low temperature. He knew that much. And he turned aside to the bank, which he climbed. On top, tangled in the underbrush about the trunks of several small spruce trees, was a high-water deposit of dry firewood. He threw down several large pieces on the top of the snow. This served for a foundation and prevented the young flame from drowning itself in the snow. It otherwise would melt. The flame he got by touching a match to a small shred of birch bark that he took from his pocket. He knew there must be no failure. When it is 75 below zero, a man mustn't fail in his first attempt to build a fire. That is, if his feet are wet. If his feet are dry and he fails, he can run along the trail for half a mile and restore his circulation. But the circulation of wet and freezing feet cannot be restored by running when it's 75 below. No matter how fast he runs, the feet will freeze the harder. All this the man knew. The old-timer in Sulphur Creek had told him about it the previous fall, and had been very serious in laying down the law that no man must travel alone in the Klondike after 50 below. He smiled as he remembered. Well, here he was. He'd had the accident. He was alone. And he had saved himself. For the first fire was a success, blazing away. He started to untie his moccasins. They were coated with ice. For a moment, he tugged with his numb fingers, and then, realizing the folly of it, drew his sheath knife. But before he could cut the strings, it happened. The tree under which he had built the fire carried a weight of snow on its boughs. High up in the tree, one bough capsized its load of snow. This fell on the boughs beneath, capsizing them. This process continued, and the snow descended without warning upon the man and the fire. And the fire was blotted out. The man was shocked. It was as though he had just heard his own sentence of death. For a moment, he sat and stared at the spot where the fire had been built, and then he grew very calm. Perhaps the old-timer of Sulphur Creek was right. If he had had only a trail mate, he would have been in no danger now. The trail mate could have rebuilt the fire. Well, it was up to him to build the fire over again, and this second time there must be no failure. Even if he succeeded, he would most likely lose some toes. His feet must be badly frozen by now, and it would be some time before the second fire was ready. The man reached in his pocket for a second piece of birch bark. He knew the bark was there, and though he couldn't feel it with his fingers, he could hear its crisp rustling as he fumbled for it. Try as he would, he couldn't clutch hold of it. The old-timer of Sulphur Creek was right, he thought, in a moment of controlled despair. After 50 below, a man should travel with a partner. He beat his hands, but failed in exciting any sensation. A certain fear of death, dull and oppressive, came to him. The fear quickly became poignant as he realized that it was no longer a mere matter of freezing his fingers and toes or of losing his hands and feet. It was a matter of life and death with the chances against him. This threw him into a panic, and he turned and ran up the creek bed along the old dim trail. He ran blindly, without intention, in fear such as he had never known in his life. His dog followed behind. The running made him feel better. He didn't shiver. Maybe if he ran on, his feet would thaw out, and anyway, if he ran far enough, he would reach camp and the boys. Without a doubt, he would lose some fingers and toes and some of his face, but the boys would take care of him. It struck him as curious that he could run at all on feet so frozen that he couldn't feel them when they struck the earth and took the weight of his body. He seemed to himself to skim along above the surface, to have no connection with the earth. His theory of running until he reached camp and the boys had one flaw in it. He lacked the endurance. Several times he stumbled, and finally he tottered, crumpled up, and fell. When he tried to rise, he failed. As he sat, regained his breath, he noted that he was feeling quite warm and comfortable.
He wasn't shivering, and it even seemed that a warm glow had come to his chest and trunk. He was losing in his battle with the frost. It was creeping into his body from all sides. When he had recovered his breath and control, he sat up and entertained in his mind the conception of meeting death with dignity. Well, he was bound to freeze anyway. He might as well take it decently. With this newfound peace of mind came the first glimmerings of drowsiness. A good idea, he thought, to sleep off to death. It was like taking an anesthetic. Freezing wasn't so bad as people thought. There were lots worse ways to die. He thought of the old-timer of Sulphur Creek, and he mumbled, "You were right, old horse. You were right." Then the man drowsed off into what seemed to him the most comfortable and satisfying sleep he'd ever known. The dog sat facing him and waited. The brief day drew to a close in a long, slow twilight. Later, the dog whined loudly. And still later, it crept close to the man and caught the scent of death. This made the animal bristle and back away. A little longer it delayed, howling under the stars that leaped and danced and shone brightly in the cold sky. Then it turned and trotted up the trail in the direction of the camp it knew to join the other food providers and fire providers.
Thank you, Nelson Olmsted. Certainly, no one could recreate the terrifying loneliness of the North as could Jack London. You can turn up the lights now. You can look around you. Nobody is there, really. Everything is all right. Isn't it? You have been listening to Sleep No More, an NBC Radio Network production directed by Daniel Sutter. Mr. Olmsted records exclusively for Vanguard Records. Until next week, when Nelson Olmsted will again be here in person, this is Ben Grauer, bidding you good night.
Well, okay, that's the end of the radio show and the readings from the LibriVox project. We're going to go into several minutes of music. Oh, by the way, although I don't usually announce what the songs are here, if you go to the trusty website, I'll bet you know what that is, www.nighttransmissions.com, I usually remember to post the name of the songs, the artist, and what other relevant information I can find.
enchanted shore. Your fickle friends are leaving. Ah, but then you know it's time for them to go.
sits in the cage, growing old. White bird must fly, or she will die. White bird must fly, or she will die. The sunset's gone, the sunset's gone. The clouds float by, and the earth turns slow, and the young birds are.